Tom Hogan went to Washington this spring with a group known as the American Disabled for Accessible Public Transit. He wanted to help Congress get through a bottleneck in the House of Representatives and get civil rights protection for the disabled passed. After President Bush signed the Americans with Disability Act into law on Thursday, Tom Hogan had a one-word reaction.
Yippee. But other than that, just general relief, and thank goodness this is, you know, we have come to the point where there is no discrimination, or there will not be discrimination within Americans' borders. It's just good to feel to be treated as a full citizen.
The Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits discrimination against the disabled in employment, public accommodations, transportation, and telecommunications. Many disabled Americans cannot work because employers won't hire them, businesses and industries are not equipped to accommodate wheelchairs, and buses, trains, and taxis aren't equipped for the disabled. Much of that will have to be corrected in phases under the new law. Hogan has lived here 13 years. He's been disabled for 7 of them after a freak accident caused a brain injury, causing semi-paralysis on his left side. In a wheelchair for the most part, Hogan is especially excited about the changes that will require accessibility.
Key items that I can see are going to be accessibility to businesses, conducting business with the public, accessibility to state and federal buildings. We have got a couple of them here in Fairbanks that are inaccessible. You cannot go in and do business with the federal government in one of the buildings and with the state government in one of their other buildings. As well, there is just the general viewpoint of the community that, yes, we need to have things like facilities, restroom facilities, et cetera, accessible, made available for individuals who are in experiencing disabilities such as they are in a wheelchair, and those will take a very effective role in the Fairbanks society.
The new legislation includes penalties for those found guilty of job discrimination against the disabled. Hogan says he hasn't been employed since his accident, but believes that Fairbanks won't have the problems other cities might when it comes to hiring the disabled.
Fairbanks area, of all of the communities, I think personally, throughout the U.S. that I've had any experience with, is the most understanding of persons who experience a disability. We seem to have one notch up on believing in the rights of each individual citizen to attain their dreams as they can see fit.
While provisions of the Act set timelines for many of the accessibility changes to take place, Hogan says it will likely take longer for society to adjust to a new way of thinking. He says there are still civil rights issues that were addressed in 1964, which haven't been resolved as a society. He hopes it won't take that long for people with disabilities. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson.
Well, there's been a lot of study on the rainforest burning down in the Amazon basin and such like that, and it's clear that those fires have a big impact on the climate and on greenhouse effect in terms of producing carbon dioxide, nitrogen oxides, hydrocarbons, ozone, aerosols, all of those species. What we don't know or what we don't have any information on yet is how important are Alaskan fires to these, to the questions of climate. And the issues of rainforest burning, we know that that's a human-caused phenomena. The wildfires in Alaska are essentially a natural phenomena, but still we're trying to assess how important these are in terms of global climate. Both produce air pollutants. We were trying to get set up for the first smoke that moved into town around July 4th, and we had some instrumentation failures. And because of that, we missed getting much data on the first smoky period. And then we were kind of disappointed, of course. But we persisted, and when it was raining right after July 4th, we got some heavy rain, and we persisted and put our instrumentation up, and lo and behold, the fires came back, and we got lots of interesting data now to look at.
3, 2, 1. Smoke was in the air around Fairbanks again Monday. Barry Rose of the Alaska Interagency Fire Information Office says more than 2,000 firefighters are fighting 15 blazes, and about half of those firefighters are working near Tok.
The main fire we're working on continues to be the Tok River fire. 1,000 people are fighting that fire, and they're making some progress. It's 76% contained today, and it's been raining in that area. So the fire has laid down, and it's a good time for them to jump on it and to continue to try to get a line around it. So we're making progress, but we're just going to have to see what the weather does. It's been damp the last couple of days, which has helped. If the sun comes out and the winds pick up, we could be in a trouble situation again. So we're watching carefully and hoping that we can continue to get a ring around these fires.
Rose says even though the rate of growth in the fires has slowed, there are still a lot of fires to blow smoke whichever way the wind is blowing. As the month of July winds down, Rose says this year it doesn't mean the fire season is winding down too.
In most years, the fire season is ending by now. But this has been an unusual year. It's been very dry. The fuels across the state are very, very dry. And we've had, a huge lightning bus, and that's just combined for a lot of fires that have burned much longer into the season than expected.
More than 2 million acres have burned in the state this year. Rose says that's about the same as the amount burned in 1988, but before that you have to go back to 1976 to find a fire season like this one in Alaska. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. The current garbage collection system, placing dumpsters around the borough for anyone to throw trash into, is popular but expensive. And setting up an efficient operation while the landfill just keeps filling up isn't easy. What the Assembly approved last night resulted from weeks of discussion and debate. Even more hours were put in this week when it looked like the policy may have difficulty getting Assembly approval. What finally passed leaves room for negotiation on specific details, but addresses the overall concern that Assemblymember John Davies points out was the goal of the committee working on the plan.
Setting a direction that we can all agree on is a worthwhile direction to head out in. We may go off to one direction or the other as we go down this path and discover that certain things work and other things don't. But we think that this is a workable direction that puts us in heading toward, in the best way we can see right now, toward the goal that we want to attain. And that the fundamental goal is that we want to have a convenient and economical and sanitary way to take care of our solid waste, including some of the minor hazardous ones.
The Assembly wants to create solid waste collection districts within the borough. A mill rate would be set for each district based on level of service. Dumpsters would be maintained in remote parts of the borough. The North Pole Transfer Station would be reopened and three more transfer stations like it would be built in more populated areas. In urban areas outside of Fairbanks and North Pole, the borough hopes to contract out for curbside pickup service. And finally, the cities of Fairbanks and North Pole would not have to change anything they're doing, but they could become or join a collection district if they choose to. Working the cities into the plan proved to be difficult to do while still pleasing everyone. So the creators of the policy decided not to press the issue. Those creators, Assemblymembers John Davies and Hank Bartos, agreed that there are still details to be worked out, and that can happen during the political process. But Bartos says the timing for this plan is critical.
I think we have an outstanding plan. It's not perfect. It still has some refinements that need to be made, and I think we can do that. It appears that we're putting this before you in a hasty manner, and there is some reason for that, and the reason is to get a ballot proposition on the ballot. We have to react at this time frame.
Agreement on how to pay for all this may be settled by borough assembly members next week when they consider placing a funding proposition on the ballot for voter approval in October. It calls for okaying a $2 million bond issue to build the three new transfer stations that the new system calls for and the remote dump site facilities. Since a mill levy will pay for the new system, tipping fees at the landfill would be reduced or eliminated, and recycling would be encouraged at the transfer stations to reduce the amount of trash being taken to the dump. Getting the whole landfill operation in private hands is still a goal of some assembly members, and that proved to be a problem point with Assemblyman Joe Ryan. The policy states that the borough shall privatize most of the landfill operations, but that the borough still retain overall ownership and management. Ryan feels that doesn't go far enough if privatization really is the goal.
You're not going to find anybody to take over that operation where you're going to sit there and tell them how to run their business, and they have to make the profit on it, and you're setting up the rules for it. It's not going to work. You're never going to privatize this dump when you're retaining overall management and ownership of the dump, because a person that comes in there to run that operation is going to have the management aspect and retain the ownership.
But since the borough retains liability problems with the landfill, assembly members say some management must remain in borough hands. Assemblyman Don Lowell.
And it is the intention of the committee to privatize everything we can. And the borough has no intention of going out and picking up garbage at the curbside. That's going to be contracted. And the intention is in here. It's very explicit what our intention is. But we still have to maintain control of the landfill. We have a legal and a moral responsibility that we can't just give away and bury our head in the sand.
Despite the objections of Joe Ryan, the 8 other assembly members at the meeting endorsed the policy statement. The next step is getting a definite funding proposal on the table for voters to review. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson.
An interest in the Native leadership about doing something with that problem. An interest by parents in participating in the educational process and in developing some sort of partnership with schools, as in the Juneau district. A focus on parenting and early childhood education and language development as a key to improving academic performance. The problem is the level of academic performance among students who come from isolated areas, whose language may not be English, who do not have the benefits of middle-class America. And we need to address the important role parents play in developing a base for learning among young children. And we need to recognize the importance of focusing on the development of that youngster's language, the development of a language base. And so if there's a major issue or problem that we still need to address, I think that's it.
Dave Mills and Jonas Ramuth from the National Park Service in Kotzebue traveled to villages on the Kobuk River last week to talk with villagers in English and Inupiaq about subsistence hunting and fishing regulations.
This fall, we'll start some discussions and meetings and working groups looking at, over the course of the next year, at what direction we would want to head in terms of changing any regulations. So it's going to be a process that involves the communities and the leaders in the region, and it should take at least a year to look at our regulations and decide on a permanent basis if we should make any changes.
When Mills visited the villages on the Kobuk River, he brought with him the subsistence liaison for the National Park Service office in Kotzebue, Jonas Ramuth. Ramuth explained in Inupiaq to the villagers the latest subsistence regulations. In Kotzebue, I'm Mark Anderson.
3, 2, 1. Restricting pull tab sales for school fundraising now is a sticky issue since they're already a moneymaker. In North Pole, the high school booster club sold pull tabs at 3 bars to raise money for trips the school couldn't afford to take otherwise. The sales drew the attention of the school board's policy review committee. That group has been working since March to determine whether or not the practice should be allowed. Even though the high school and the students were not involved in the fundraising effort, school board member Bonnie Brody doesn't think pull tabs are appropriate.
You don't raise money by expecting drunks to sit in bars buying lots of pull tabs, and that money will go to the schools. I think that kind of ethics and that message in that ethics gets sent to our kids. I think the kids should be willing to earn the money or not travel as much or not buy as much equipment, or the school district should fund a higher level of student activities. But I don't think that using gambling to support our school activities sends the kind of message I want to have sent to my students and my own children.
Part of the reason North Pole needs an innovative approach to fundraising is the competition among schools. Students want to be able to take outside trips like students at the Fairbanks schools, but the economic base isn't as broad. School board members are divided on the issue. Board President Jerry McBeth sees practical and philosophical differences.
Some communities, North Pole in particular, raise a lot of money through pull tabs. I don't know if the figure of $16,000 is correct or not, but it's in the $10,000 to $20,000 range, and that goes to the support of school activities. That's also a community with fewer kinds of community organizations that contribute time and effort toward the school. And so one of the issues to be considered is the impact of any kind of prohibition of pull tab proceeds on a community such as that in North Pole. The other issue is just the nature of the enterprise, whether the school district should be encouraging people to buy pull tabs in order to use the proceeds to finance school activities, whether that is a position for a school district to take.
As chairman of the Policy Review Committee recommending the change, board member Andy Warwick says it's an issue that the board should decide. Warwick says he's not a proponent of pull tabs, but notes most nonprofit groups do use them to raise money. He says North Pole High School needs additional funds, and either pull tabs should be allowed or the board should find another source of revenue for the school. He's also worried that a policy banning their use would be tough to enforce and could be restrictive when it comes to accepting money from other groups which raise the funds through pull tabs. He's not sure where you draw the line.
A good example is the parent-teacher organization of a school. The school doesn't have any control over that organization. The same with some booster clubs. You know, those are organized independently of the school district. And while we may have some subtle controls over them, we do not have legal control over their activities. And they may raise money from pull tabs and from car washes and from a host of other operations. And how do we differentiate what money comes from where? Can we say, well, we'll accept the money from the car wash but not from the pull tabs? When money is raised and put into account, it's like water in a bathtub. It's indistinguishable.
But Bonnie Brody doesn't see control as a problem.
I don't think we'd want to accept money from the Ku Klux Klan, and I don't think we'd want to accept money from a gambling ring or a house of prostitution. You know, we divested in South Africa. We can do that for our state's investments. We can certainly control whether money's raised from pull tabs.
Board member Walt Schlofelt also doesn't think pull tabs are an appropriate way to raise money, but Mike Kramer and Carl Schroeder support the method. Kramer has no problem with the group raising money legally for the kids' benefit.
Although the district funds activities at a reasonably good level, I think there are some extra opportunities that some of the schools have, maybe not every year, but every so often that they might be able to travel some, and I think that's good for them. And they need extra money to do that. And I think that sometimes money-raising events like car washes and garage sales are fine because it gets the kids involved in earning their own money, but it just plain isn't sufficient, you know, to pay for some of the things that they would like to do.
The school board probably won't take up the issue until next month when school is back in session and public hearings will show community opinion. But board members may take up another gambling issue at next week's meeting. A resolution opposing the statewide gambling initiative on the August 28th primary ballot is up for board approval. The resolution cites an unhealthy and unwholesome environment for young people that legalized gambling may create. Most board members indicate support for such a resolution. Carl Schroeder, who does support selling pull tabs to raise money for school activities, says the gambling initiative is a different story.
That is a completely horse of a different color, and I think that that would so
adversely affect the character of Fairbanks and other Alaskan towns, that I would be opposed to it. I mean, the only reason that gambling works in other states is that they have more losers than we have.
That resolution comes to the board Tuesday night. If approved, board members go on the record opposing the gambling initiative on the primary ballot, while urging parents and community members to defeat the proposition. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. The governor cut money from the state budget for snow and ice removal on Class 3 roads. That means close to 400 borough road miles, which will be affected as early as this winter. Assemblymember Don Lowell is sponsoring a ballot proposition that would give the borough the power to maintain those roads. Even though the borough doesn't have the money to pay for clearing the roads this winter, Lowell says that's not a problem.
We can find a way to fund it, either through revenue anticipation notes. We can borrow the money. We still have a fund balance. We've spent the fund balance for a lot less important things than road maintenance. So what are we going to do? Are we going to sit here and say, well, the snow's going to fall and somebody else is going to take care of the roads? Or are we going to go out and plan for it? And so I'm suggesting that we put on the ballot and let the people themselves speak up. Do they want the roads maintained or not?
Other assembly members called the proposal premature and ill-conceived, but agreed to let it go to a public hearing. They say the public may not know what to expect when the snow flies and no one can afford to remove it from rural roads. Two other ballot issues would ask voters to approve bond issues. One calls for $2 million to build the garbage transfer stations that assembly members see as the first part of a comprehensive solution to the borough's garbage problems. The second is a $5 million bond issue for maintenance of borough buildings. Sponsored by Mayor Juanita Helms, the proposal would pay for what the mayor sees as the most urgent maintenance problems in borough buildings. The mayor couldn't get money from the assembly for all the projects she wanted to undertake this year, and she believes $5 million is a reasonable amount to ask from the voters for preventive maintenance.
You save money in the long run by doing good preventive maintenance on buildings. And at this point, we just don't have funding in the budget to do it. And I think it's important to at least let the community decide whether they think it's important.
The mayor is recommending a bond authorization that would be financed over 10 years. She estimates that for each $100,000 in property value, it would add about $30 to the annual tax bill. All three ballot propositions are up for a public hearing Thursday night at the Borough Assembly meeting. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
This will be a working trip for the secretary. He'll be visiting in each community. The particular health care sites and treatment centers, and in particular one area that we're looking into closely is the substance abuse problem in Alaska, and the unique problems faced in trying to reduce substance abuse in Alaska. It's one of the reasons why he accepted the senator's invitation to address the conference in Anchorage.
The summary of the gambling proposal is supposed to be a neutral explanation of what the initiative would do, told in the simplest and clearest possible language. But concern is growing within the Attorney General's office and elsewhere that the summary has been changed by the Lieutenant Governor's office in a way that could be misleading and could encourage some Alaskans to vote for the measure who might not if they had more complete information. At issue is a single word involving who will be eligible to run the new gambling operations if this measure passes and local governments approve. Assistant Attorney General Kathleen Strasbaugh had recommended that the summary refer to the entities allowed to run gambling operations as the state, municipalities, and bars. But when the language emerged from the Lieutenant Governor's office, it referred to the state, municipalities, and other groups. The change doesn't affect the initiative itself, but could affect voters' understanding of what it does. Critics point out that by replacing bars with other groups, the summary conceals the link between dispensers of alcohol and gambling that was clearly intended by supporters of the initiative. They also point out that some voters could take those others to be something entirely different, such as charities or other worthy causes. John Havelock heads up the anti-gambling group No Dice. He says minor word changes can have major impacts on the fate of ballot initiatives.
And of course, the change being put in is intended to tilt a proposition which is already strongly phrased to support the adoption of the proposition to make it even more strongly tilted in that direction.
As Lieutenant Governor, McAlpine has the final control over the wording of the neutral summaries for all the ballot propositions. Unlike Governor Cooper, Stephen McAlpine is a supporter of gambling in Alaska. McAlpine says his task is to try and draw a neutral line between supporters and opponents of any proposition, and he says his office changed bars to other groups in an effort to be more accurate. But critics like Havelock say the change had exactly the opposite effect, making the language less accurate and concealing the fact that if this initiative clears the voters and local governments, holders of state liquor licenses, already a closed circle of Alaskans, may see the value of those licenses shoot up dramatically. Attorney General Douglas Bailey is expected to have a statement on this issue later in the week. In Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Ever since the state bought the Alaska Railroad from the federal government in 1985, truckers have been campaigning for a change in the way the railroad does its business. More than 20,000 Alaskans have signed a petition calling for sweeping reforms at the railroad, enough names to place the proposal on this month's primary ballot. Patrick Cox prepared this report.
Each day, the Alaska Railroad hauls more petroleum than any other product, including passengers. Since state ownership, the railroad has increased its share of the petroleum market by 25%. The trucking industry has experienced a corresponding decline in business. Individual, self-employed truckers are suffering the most, and they represent the core of the support for the ballot proposal. The large trucking and shipping firms are remaining publicly neutral on the issue, but it's clear that they too would benefit from a change in the law. The proposal's authors are calling for 7 separate amendments to the current law governing the railroad. The thrust of these amendments is to more clearly delineate the boundaries of the company's ownership by the state. Right now, according to the trucking interests, the railroad is hiding itself behind its status as a semi-state agency.
They are acting as a secret organization, more secret than the CIA, and then calling themselves a state agency.
Don Hennessy is a retired trucker and co-sponsor of the proposal.
If a state agency is not going to be subjected to the same penalties a private corporation is, you shouldn't call them a private corporation. You should call them a state agency. They can't be both.
Hennessy argues that the railroad should open up its books and contracts for public inspection. Then, he says, Alaskans would see the extent to which the state is providing subsidies to the railroad. Subsidies which allow the railroad to charge artificially low rates, thereby undercutting the truckers and running them out of business. Not everyone sees it that way, though. Horace Hunt at the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce says that because the railroad is a state-owned corporation, it is doubly answerable to public scrutiny.
The Alaska Railroad Corporation is one of the most audited entities in our state, and the last thing they need is another entity coming in and looking at their books. Their books are open, and they're open to the public, and I don't think we need someone else asking the Alaska Railroad Corporation to open up their books.
As for the railroad, it says that not only does it open its books in greater detail than strictly private firms, but also that those books reveal a healthy, self-sufficient organization, financially independent of state support. Frank Turpin is the corporation's president.
Well, the state does not put any money into the operation of the railroad. In the 5.5 years that we've been operating, we've had to earn all of our own operating funds plus all of our capital investment funds. Everything that we earn is reinvested into the railroad.
The truckers say the railroad's financial health has been underwritten by the state, and that amounts to unfair competition. They point to a number of in-kind state subsidies. The railroad, for example, pays no property tax, and from time to time, the state buys railroad equipment on the railroad's behalf. Such capital acquisitions can make the railroad a lot of money. Just last week, the railroad sold 18 state-purchased grain cars for nearly $600,000. The state received a little more than half of the money from the sale. The rest went to the railroad. The state is also planning to order 5 engines and 75 cars for the Wishbone Hill coal project at a cost of $9 million. The railroad gets to use the equipment for free during the 12 to 15 years of the project. Furthermore, it gets to keep the engines and cars afterwards at no cost. Don Hennessy contends that such in-kind subsidies hurt more than just the trucking industry. Support for the initiative, he says, is broad-based. Roadhouses, repair shops, and Alaskans who don't want to see the state expanding any further have all worked on the petition.
The railroad has continuously said this is nothing but a bunch of sorehead Jippo truckers trying to fight the railroad. It has never been that. I have nothing to gain by trucks hauling more freight.
If Hennessy has no personal stake in increased trucking business, others do. An increased business is exactly what truckers will see if the initiative succeeds. Not only would the subsidies stop, but the railroad would be limited to operating in Alaska. Right now, the railroad can operate as a, quote, prime carrier outside. That allows the railroad to ship goods through the lower 48 and make money from each shipper it subcontracts with. But the truckers say that places them at a competitive disadvantage, and they want the railroad limited to operating solely in Alaska. State Representative Virginia Collins would also like to see that happen, so the two interests can compete on an even field.
When you're talking about subsidies, you're talking about really the flexibility that either industry has to survive in time of need. And unfortunately, the trucking industry has nowhere to go when times get bad and they don't have the money. But the railroad has the opportunity to go to the legislature, and they've been very good about not doing that. And I think that Mr. Turpin and the board have done a great job, so that they've not had to come to the legislature. But generally speaking, they don't have the risk that the private sector trucking industry does. And I think that's really what creates the problem and makes it difficult for people to stay in business doing trucking.
Whether or not the initiative is approved by voters on August 28th, it's unlikely the issue will disappear. The railroad says that if it loses and the state is obliged to enforce the new amendments, the railroad will take the state to court. And the truckers say they've been campaigning for so long that they don't intend to give up if the vote goes against them this time.
3-2-1. The issue before Fairbanks Superior Court Judge Meg Green on Monday focused on the $80 million in the trust now. Trust earnings must first be spent on mental health needs before they can be used for other state programs. The legislature appropriated $44 million for mental health programs this year. But lawyers for the mental health trust beneficiaries say that's not enough to meet the needs of their clients, so the state isn't entitled to the $80 million left in the trust. Attorney David Walker.
It was our claim, and is our claim, remains our claim, that the state has not met the expenses, has not filled the needs, and therefore it should not be entitled to transfer that money from the mental health trust income account into the general fund.
Whether or not the state is meeting mental health needs will be decided in court later. Walker wanted the judge to grant an injunction stopping the state from putting that money into the general fund and spending it, just in case the Mental Health Coalition eventually wins that case. But the state was counting on rolling the money over into this year's budget. Assistant Attorney General Thomas Custer argued over the phone from Juneau that the legislature has already finished with the budget, and an injunction holding up the trust fund still would not mean any more money would be spent on mental health programs. But Custer successfully argued the state would suffer irreparable harm without the money.
We had opposed the motion for the preliminary injunction because we felt that it was inappropriate for the court to keep that money in the mental health trust income account when the potential consequence of that was to result in an unbalanced budget for the rest of state government, and I guess we're pleased that the court agreed with us.
Although she allowed the transfer, the judge did raise questions about the wisdom of relying on surplus funds to balance the budget and advised the legislature against that practice. Lead attorney for the trust beneficiaries, David Walker, was glad to hear that, although disappointed that the transfer will be allowed.
I don't consider it a setback in the litigation, though. I think that the court's admonishing the legislature to view this very carefully in the future is a great help to us, and we're still going on with the hearing in which, on the facts, as everybody talked about, we'll determine whether or not the state has mismanaged the trust and has failed to meet those needs, and I believe that we'll certainly establish it at the hearing.
The mental health lands dispute has been in the courts for years. In 1985, the state Supreme Court ruled that the legislature illegally dissolved a 1 million-acre land trust that was to pay for mental health programs. Negotiations to resolve the matter since then have bogged down over the value of the land. Last month, Judge Green stopped the state from giving away any more of the land from the trust. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson.
There's a court
case pending right now with Judge Holland in federal court, which requests the judge to close the Nelchina caribou hunt, which is south of the Alaska range, but is extremely popular with people of South Central and quite a few people from the interior. And another organization has requested that that restraining order also be applied to both the 40-mile hunt and the Macomb hunt. So the judge is supposed to rule on these requests by Friday morning. We don't know for a fact that the hunts are going to be open, and we don't want to issue permits in case the hunt isn't going to be open. Another effect is that if the Nelchina is closed for hunters so that they're not able to go to the Nelchina and the other two are left open, the hunting pressure could shift, and these herds are not as large as the Nelchina herd, and consequently we may have to close some seasons to protect the wildlife resource.
He's approaching, you know, within a shouting distance of 50% of the crude oil supply known to exist in the world. That's the reserves, and that's money in the bank, regardless of how you cut it. So that's why this crisis is so significant. That's why the U.S. is trying to make a determination of what role it should play, and it's a tough set of facts, because it really isn't our fight in the sense that it's not in our part of the world, but it becomes our fight because we're so darn dependent on that supply of crude oil, and it makes one question, you know, the realities of why we've allowed ourselves to become so dependent when we have other alternatives.
3-2-1. If approved by voters, the gambling initiative would legalize all types of gambling, from casinos to dog races. That's reason enough for some school board members to urge voters to turn it down. If the community did agree to legalize gambling, Bonnie Brody doesn't think the educational environment would be the same.
People choose to settle in a community based on the quality of the environment and the quality of the schools, and that demographically Fairbanks has a young population, as does the rest of Alaska, and young families have children. And there is a definite correlation of an increase in drug traffic, substance abuse, organized crime, and activities that are not conducive to family living when there's supported legalized gambling. I would not mind visiting Las Vegas or Atlantic City, and I have, but I wouldn't choose to bring my family up there or have my children attend schools in those communities.
Board members and the district administration say schools would see the effects of legalized gambling as crime and corruption would increase. But the vote to oppose the ballot initiative was not unanimous. Mike Kramer doesn't think the school board should take a stand on something the voters will decide.
It's a draw the line type of issue for me, and the parallel was brought up tonight concerning marijuana, and we did go on record to recriminalize marijuana. But marijuana is something that the kids can use in school and can affect their education and their day-to-day well-being. I suppose the point could be made that a gambling type atmosphere could indirectly do that, and I couldn't argue with that. But I just think that it's not something that the board should get involved in.
The resolution adopted by the board opposes the gambling question on the ballot and urges parents and other citizens to protect the well-being of kids and defeat the proposition. But the district does not plan to actively campaign against it. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. 3-2-1. The United States imports more than half its oil, but now without oil from Iraq and Kuwait, Senator Frank Murkowski says the pressure to come up with crude oil is only going to increase. During a news conference, Murkowski admitted that the Middle East situation offers the opportunity to renew the call to explore for oil in Anwar.
Clearly, we have to use every opportunity we have to gain momentum on the issue of Anwar and educate many people who are concerned with the porcupine caribou herd. They're concerned with what they have heard about Anwar. Unfortunately, many people haven't been advised that the area is a huge area of 18 million acres, and we're proposing to lease a very small part.
Any realistic appraisal of our national energy picture makes it abundantly clear that drilling the Arctic Refuge isn't the answer to our nation's real problems of energy security. It merely perpetuates the gross overconsumption, which has led our country into the bind we're in right now.
Northern Alaska Environmental Center Director Rex Blazer says this country doesn't have enough oil reserves to seriously make a difference if the goal is to replace foreign oil. That's why he says the answer is to change the usage.
This is a very opportunistic exploitation of a political crisis by our delegation. To hail the Arctic Refuge as the answer to our dependence on foreign oil is a dangerous fallacy. It's like putting a drain in the floor to fix a leak in the roof. And the leak in the roof is our dependence on foreign oil and the waste that we have in this country.
Senator Murkowski says environmentalist objections have to be balanced with reality. He's moved a proposal through the U.S. Senate that he calls an action plan to reduce the dependence on foreign oil. He says it has two key action-oriented items.
It mandates an action program, and it passed the Senate last Thursday evening, and I was very pleased because it's the first thing we have to respond to the crisis that suggests a program of forecasting and then sets up an action program which I think very likely will include the alternatives, and ANWR is probably the most promising of all alternatives.
Murkowski says even though it would take some time to get oil production online in the Arctic Refuge, you have to start somewhere, and it makes sense to check it out. But Blazer says Murkowski's plan shows a shopkeeper's mentality, looking at the supply side and not demand. And he calls recommended conservation measures in Murkowski's proposal lip service.
I guess the only good thing you can say about this sort of media blitz by the delegation is that nobody takes them very seriously in D.C.
Both Murkowski and Blazer use analogies between oil and drugs to make their points. In a news release, Murkowski states that OPEC has fed us cheap oil like a drug dealer developing a dependency, and the domestic oil industry is wasting away like a drug addict's body. But Blazer says to solve our oil addiction, Murkowski's approach is to look for where to get the next fix. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
The legislation setting up the commission was passed just before Congress adjourned last weekend and is on its way for President Bush's signature. When up and operating, the commission will do what hasn't been done in more than 20 years. Make a comprehensive assessment of how programs and policies for Native Alaskans are working. The problem is that the amount of federal money spent on Native Alaskan programs has not brought about the expected results. Alcoholism, mental health, and drug prevention programs are notable examples, says Rick Agnew, Minority Counsel for the House Interior Committee.
We have had existing programs that have received a fair amount of funding, but they don't seem to be that effective, and it's not through lack of effort by the health professionals or the groups involved, but we seem to have a significantly higher rate of suicide and alcoholism, and these programs that we have don't seem to be having the right impact, a significant enough impact.
That, says Agnew, is where the commission comes in.
One of the ideas behind the commission is to look at the effectiveness of those programs on alcoholism and drug treatment and see where we can make a change that would more effectively address the needs of rural Alaska.
The commission will have 14 members, half appointed by Alaska's governor, the other half by President Bush. Rick Agnew says the intent is to get a special caliber of people on the commission.
The sponsors have talked about that they want people with experience in the field, with knowledge of the needs out there, and this is difficult to quantify. Somebody who has some creativity and has some ability to break the ice on existing programs, and so that the recommendations of the commission don't just come forward with funding changes in existing programs.
Governor Steve Cooper has already said he will appoint at least 4 Native Alaskans to the commission. He's urging President Bush to do the same. Sponsors hope the commission will begin operation soon after President Bush signs the authorizing legislation. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
The video released by the Attorney General takes a dim view of casino gambling by mocking an attempt by Las Vegas to lure gamblers who want to fly.
Sunday,
Next, viewers get a message from Attorney General Bailey himself.
On the surface, casino gambling appears fun, exciting, and even glamorous. But in reality, it invites crime, corruption, and untold social ills.
The video was released at a crucial time, just 3 weeks before an election in which casino gambling has become the issue separating the two leading Democratic gubernatorial candidates. Tony Knowles is against the initiative. Stephen McAlpine says while he is also against casino gambling, he supports the initiative, which will allow voters to decide the fate of big league gambling in their towns. As lieutenant governor, it's McAlpine's job to write the ballot initiative summaries for all state elections, and it was he who recently changed the ballot initiative summary. The change comes under fire by some who say the new wording makes the prospect of casino gambling more benign. Attorney General Bailey denied this was why his office released the anti-gambling video.
Governor Cooper's position and concerns at this time, and that my position and my concerns at this time, have absolutely nothing to do with why the language on the ballot reads the way it does. There is no investigation pending by my office. There is no investigation pending by any other state agency or individual into the why or the who of the ballot language.
But the video makes clear what's at issue. If the initiative is approved, state and local governments would be able to run casinos, as would businesses that hold liquor licenses. In the controversial rewrite, McAlpine changed the wording to say that gambling licenses would be issued to the state, municipalities, and, quote, other groups. There was no mention of liquor licenses. McAlpine says he stands by the new wording of the summary and agrees that the video isn't specifically targeted at his campaign.
I'm not willing to characterize it as a cheap shot. I think that what was done was done. I'm willing to accept it as part of the process and to go forward.
The Attorney General, though, says he made the video because 2 points need clarification. First, local gambling initiatives will only need the approval of 5% of voters in order to put the initiative on a local ballot. Other initiatives need 20% voter approval. Bailey's other point centers on who gets to open a casino.
The initiative is also, I think, very craftily put together to create a vested economic interest group in obtaining legalized gambling, those people that have beverage dispensary licenses.
Bailey's office plans to distribute the video on the state's rural access television and to any other interested parties. The cost of producing the video, he says, was negligible. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm John McWhorter.